The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great, and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe,
and your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome to this edition of the Modern Wrong World Made Right. Calvin Was Wrong, Volume 2. Episode number 9, I believe. And if you have missed any of the previous episodes, you can download all of them at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. If you are a Founders Pass member, today would be a great day to become a Founders Pass member. We are live today on the 4th of October, 2016. Because tonight there is a Vice President's debate, and we will cover it live on the site at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. And in addition to that, there'll be a live chat room that will be available for members only, Founders Pass members only. So check that out tonight at 8 Central, 9 East. And in the course of the two volumes that we have covered here, the works of St. Robert Bellarmine, the first, The Controversy on the Roman Pontiff, Volume 1 and Volume 2. We completed that series a couple of months ago. Now we're on the second series, which is the study of the Antichrist of Antichrist. And we've done 12 chapters of the Antichrist book, and we're at chapter 13 now. And if you'd like to get a copy of the book Antichrist by St. Robert Bellarmine, then you can find it in the Founders Trade and Post at MikeChurch.com or at Ryan's site at MediatrixPress.com. That's MediatrixPress. That's MediatrixPress.com. And we will go now live to our Latinist expert and the translator of the work, Ryan Grant, who is joining us live from Idaho. Brother Grant, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Hey, today is also, and I meant to put this in a note that I sent to you, today is also the feast day or the celebration commemoration day of St. Francis of Assisi.
That's correct. And St. Robert Bellarmine was actually born on St. Francis's feast day.
So today is Bellarmine's birthday?
Yes, yeah, it's actually his birthday. And so his baptismal baptismal name was also Francis. And he was distinguished when he was, especially when he was a cardinal, for a mania for almsgiving, and so much so that he was called in Rome, they called him the Il Nuovo Paparello, which is the new St. Francis. Paparello, the lover of poverty, was the term given to St. Francis by the people in his day. And so Bellarmine was so solicitous for the poor, and it really stood out as a cardinal. You know, he went into his house, you know, they'd bring out nice things for people and whatnot, but there was nothing fancy, there was nothing particularly special. You know, Bellarmine himself would just try to make sure he could do with the minimum, bare minimum number of servants that could be tolerated as a cardinal. He hated being a cardinal. He did not want it at all. There was even one time where, actually it happened several times, he was out, he was getting into the carriage because he had to go do something at the Vatican. So as he's on his way up there, because he was on virtually every papal commission of some sort, because they wanted him as the main theologian on everything.
Right.
So he's obliged to get to the Vatican for all these different meetings, business, and whatnot. So on his way, he meets this poor guy, and he didn't have any money on him at all or anything to give. So then he took his cardinal's ring and gave it to the guy and told him to go to a certain pawnbroker and take it there. And so the guy did. And then Bellarmine went back later and bought the ring because it would have been a huge scandal if he'd pawned his cardinal's ring. So, and then, of course, he knew the pawnbroker, too. So this thing's going back and forth a number of times.
That is an incredible story. Of course, it's tempered by the fact that if you know the story of St. Francis of Assisi, that he, I don't know how accurate the portrayal is in one of the movies that I've seen of when he has his, I'm going to take up orders, or I don't want the wealth or the dowry that you're going to give me, Father, and strips all his clothes off in the center of the town square, and he goes to the door of the church, which is right there, and asks the bishop to take him in, and then takes up a sackcloth as his garment, and then, I guess, famously or infamously, ties the string around his waist, and it's the garb of the Franciscan ever since. I got to tell you, I don't know if you know Brother Alexis Bugnolo, but he is of the Franciscan order, and he was at the St. Benedict Conference Center conference, and he is founding a new order, Ryan. It's called Ordo Militaris, and it's basically a Christian army that he wants to raise to go over to assist the remaining Christian populations in Syria and in Lebanon and in Libya and in Iraq and other places where they are still being attacked and besieged by ISIS and don't have the kind of weaponry and other know-how that they need to fight back or to resist. and I had never met a Franciscan. This was my first encounter with a Franciscan. So he had the sackcloth. Was trotting around on the sandals and was as humble and modest and unassuming. I don't think he had anything else on his person other than the tunic or the sackcloth or whatever you call it. Have you ever actually met a Franciscan?
Yeah, actually, I went to a university. It was run by Franciscans, so I've known quite a few.
Oh, okay. So they all try to follow the tradition. I imagine today's a...
Well, some of them do. Some of them are absolutely wonderful. And then some of them, well, you know what? Not so much.
Not so much. Well, it's great to catch up on the lives of saints like St. Francis of Assisi. And as I was reading his partial bio today, and I had forgotten this part. I guess he got the stigmata very late in his life and only lived to have it for, if the story I read today is accurate, for 2 years.
That's about right. It might have been a little more than that, but interestingly, that ties into St. Robert Bellarmine, too, because he was on the commission when he was the papal theologian of Clement VIII. He was on the commission for the reform of the breviary, which dealt with a lot of the Feast of the Saints, and it was his work that put the stigmata of St. Francis on the general calendar on 17 September, which actually is also the day he died. And you know, we know that St. Robert always had a great devotion to St. Francis. Mm-hmm. So, but that seems, so when you have that feast in the Roman calendar on September 17th for the stigmata, the reason is because of Bellarmine. Otherwise, it would just simply have been a local feast on the Franciscan calendar, and then the Universal Church wouldn't have it.
Interesting. Well, let's proceed to our discussion today. We left off, we've done 12 chapters, and I believe we are on chapter number 13 on Antichrist. on the seat of Antichrist. And again, I always reset this subject here of Calvin was wrong and all the work of St. Robert Bellarmine, that it is quite a thing to behold, folks. And by the end of today's episode, you will know what I'm talking about, that Bellarmine is able to answer all of the charges, every single one of them, down to charges contained within sentences, in between commas or semicolons, that were put forward by Martin Luther and the Lutheran, quote, reformers, close quote, during the 16th century about the Roman pontiff and about the legitimacy of the pontiff and the sole legitimacy of the Roman Church and the Roman Catholic Church. And Bellarmine is so thorough in his refutations that he leaves no stone unturned, to use the old adage. And in leaving no stone unturned, most of his arguments are basically historical or polemical, and they're not theological, and such as that has been the case with Antichrist. And we've also noted with some glee, Ryan and I, and St. Robert Bellarmine was also blessed with a very healthy sense of humor. And there's humor that runs through some of the work because he just dismisses some of the ridiculous charges made by the Protestant reformers, as if to say that I've heard a lot of dumb things in my life as a priest and then a cardinal and then whatever he was on those councils, but that takes the cake. And one of those that we heard a couple of weeks ago is when we did I think we did an entire day on the number series, the series of numbers 6, 6, and 6, and how this was arrived at through what is the method where you use the numbers to or the alphanumeric characters to arrive at numbers?
It's called gematria.
Gematria, right.
It's very popular in Semitic languages, and especially because when you're using letters from the alphabet for numbers, different number combinations will actually make a name or a word. And so gematria is very popular in Hebrew, for instance, and that's why, you know, it's natural out of the Hebrew mind. Even though the Apocalypse is written in Greek, the Book of the Apocalypse, where you find that gematria there, if it is gematria, that is. You know, it fits, because I know, like, we think we mentioned there's some people that think it's not gematria at all.
Right.
But either way, it has the, it's a very Hebrew thing to create, you know, names out of numbers. And to do that, there's a lot of different popular combinations of that in Hebrew. So, and they can do it in Greek, and the Greeks did it in other nations, Celtic ones. We talked all about that in that episode.
We did. Yeah, we covered an awful lot. So on to chapter 13, we continue to the 6. Our adversaries imprudently affirm that their particular seat of Antichrist is Rome, or even founded upon the apostolic throne at Rome. And I'll let you take it from there.
So Bellarmine starts off to summarize the argument. And so he summarizes basically what all the heretics generally tend to teach. Namely, that at some point, although he's shown previously the dates differ amongst the various Protestant writers, that Antichrist will take over the Roman See, and he will, some of them cite that there'll be an army of priests prepared for them. So the Protestants say, "Aha, see, and there's the Roman Church is an army of priests. So therefore, obviously, there must also be Antichrist." And then the Pope, therefore, will sit and reign as Antichrist on the chair of Peter. You know, because it says in 2 Thessalonians, Antichrist will sit in the temple. Okay, so this is the main, you know, Protestant argument, and it's Bellarmine, you know, responds briefly to say, you know, just the same, our opinion, the true opinion, is that the seat of Antichrist will be Jerusalem, not Rome, and the temple of Solomon, as well as the throne of David, not the temple of St. Peter or the apostolic see. So when it says he shall sit in the temple, and we'll go back to that point later.
Okay.
Bellarmine argues that it's not Rome, you know, it's not the universal church, but it'll actually be Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. And so then, first he has one argument to refute it, and then he'll prove it from the scriptures. So the first argument he takes up to refute kind of the common teaching, he says, first let me establish the argument. Let us say that Antichrist will sit in the Church of Christ, and he will be held as a prince and head of the church. And in that, he will manage the magistracy, that means rule, in offices as Melanchthon, Calvin, and the other heretics teach.
Okay.
Moreover, under this plan, the Roman Pope is Antichrist, as these writers teach in the same places. Therefore, the Roman Pope sits in the true Church of Christ and is the prince and head of the church. But there can only be one true Church of Christ, just as Christ is one, as even Calvin teaches. Therefore, the Lutherans, Calvinists, and others are outside the church, which is under the Pope, that is, outside of the true Church of Christ. Now, Calvin sees this argument, so Bellarmine continues here. So it's this is what's called a reductio ad absurdum, okay, or a refutation of the argument from the effect. So he says, let's say all that's true. The Pope, the Antichrist, will come into the church and rule. That means that he's ruling in the true church, isn't he? So Calvin sees the argument, Bellarmine says, and he does in the Institutes. He addresses that possibility. And he responds that the church is not under the Pope as much as the ruins of the Church of Christ are seen there. He says this in the Institutes, quote, this is Calvin now, still, as in ancient times there remained among the Jews certain special privileges of a church, so in the present day we do not deny that the papists have those vestiges of a church which the Lord has allowed to remain among them amid this dissipation. He provided by his providence that there should be other remains also to prevent the church from utterly perishing. Yet when they pulled down buildings, the foundations and ruins are often permitted to remain. So he did not suffer Antichrist either to subvert his church from its foundation or to level it to the ground, but was pleased that amid the devastation the edifice should remain, though half in ruins. Hence we scarcely deny that churches remain under his tyranny. And so this is, that's Calvin, unquote. So now Bellarmine answers that his solution provides two arguments for us. One, if only the ruins of the Church of Christ remain, therefore the Church of Christ is ruined. Hence, truth lied, that is, the truth as in Christ, lied when he said, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. The church is ruined, so the second possibility is that the church is ruined as well as its ruins in the foundation, so that the papists hold semi-ruined buildings. Therefore, the Lutherans and the Calvinists have no church at all. For they do not have the whole Church of Christ, since it is now a ruin, and still the ruins remain. But they do not even have the edifice, for that is with the papists under Antichrist. Therefore, what is it that they have? Maybe a new building? But that which is new is not of Christ. But who, unless he were blind, doesn't see that he is safer in the true Church of Christ, even if it's just an edifice, than to remain in nothing? Right, so completely, you know, so that's what we call the you know, tolerating an absurd hypothesis. So he says, so if it was true, this is what you get, that the true Church of Christ is with us, or the ruins of it, and they don't have anything. So which, and of course, in the argument that they take, it's actually necessitated, because they're arguing that Antichrist took over, the Protestants are arguing that Antichrist took over the true church, which had the economy and had Peter as an authority and a successor of Peter. A lot of them actually argue this and reverence early popes like St. Leo the Great, and even some of them St. Gregory the Great, like Calvin. And so they're basically arguing that, yeah, he did have that authority in the church, but now it's lost because Antichrist took it over, right?
Right.
Well, that means that the religion and the system that they're predicating is not what the Lord founded. It's not the economy, so to speak, the plan of salvation that was established by Christ in the apostles, who, as Clement the Roman says, went preaching and teaching in every city, substituting successors for themselves. We never see any of the fathers saying they just stopped and gave everyone a Bible and said, here you go, you know, all you need is this. Right? It doesn't happen. There is a serious economy, and it's structured from the early church, and that's why a lot of Protestant writers had a lot of fear of the fathers, and the only one to take them on are in two ways. Calvin would take Augustine and try to baptize him into a Calvinist by cutting and pasting. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of that in Book 4, where Bellarmine reveals how, to what extent Calvin has cut and pasted Augustine to make him sound like a Calvinist, when he's exactly the opposite. But then also in Illyricus's Centuries of Magdeburg, where he tries to write this church history with only one goal, to show the early church is Lutheran and the Roman church Antichrist, right? Well, even there, he's got to deal with the fact that the fathers teach what Catholics teach and not what Lutherans teach in many respects. So I think I noted that it says, Bellarmine says this in On the Marks of the Church, that our adversaries, he says, speaking of Illyricus, call these the blemishes of Tertullian and the blemishes of Cyprian and the blemishes of Augustine. Even though they could call the very same doctrines when they're found amongst us to be heresies.
Fascinating stuff here. You know, I was thinking about this when we were talking. I was actually thinking, I wrote this to a correspondent the other day. When I was asked about it, and this is coming up in, what, today is the 4th, so we got 9 days until the miracle of the sun, the 99th anniversary. Right? I don't think I'm not sure I want to be around when the 100th comes around, if certain events have not transpired. But anyways, he was the correspondent had asked me, well, is any of this Fatima stuff in the Bible? And I said, well, not per, no, it's not in the Bible. Then, you know, of course, the response was, well, then it can't be true, and it didn't happen. And I said,
are stocks and bonds in the Bible?
Well, wait a minute.
And back to religion, is the Trinity in the Bible?
That's right.
It doesn't say the word Trinity anywhere. So how can you use the word Trinity? I mean, the idea of it's talked about, but the word doesn't show up there. So how do you get the idea of Trinity? You know, when that's not in the Bible. Faith alone. Faith alone only appears in one place, except in Luther's Bible because he added it. And it only appears in one place, and that's in James, where it says faith alone doesn't save.
Well, I continue the argument, though. I didn't even get to those. My only response was, because we were somewhere in the string, he had brought up the Apostle Paul. And I said, newsflash, the Apostle Paul didn't have a Bible. He might have been writing some of the books that ultimately went into it. He certainly didn't have the Gospels at the time. And when the apostles were dispatched after Pentecost out to go save, to teach all men of all nations, they didn't have Bibles either. So there was nothing in a Bible. So anyway, they just thought that I'd drop that in. And of course, to add to the points that you made, this is the Modern Wrong World Made Right. This is Calvin Was Wrong, Volume Number 2, Episode Number 10. And we are now in Chapter 13 of Antichrist, on the Sea of Antichrist. I kind of lost my place in the English version of the translation as you were going along, so I'm not exactly sure where we are. But
if you're in the just the volume that says Antichrist, rather than the full volume that's in, although the volume that's just called Antichrist, that's just Book 3 of On the Roman Pontiff. It's slightly abridged. And that is certain arguments at the end are taken out. We can talk about those. Those are in On the Roman Pontiff, Book 3 in full. Although this entire section is there as it is in the book. So if you have just the one, you know, just Antichrist, it's page 115.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm on the right page. Now I come to the scriptures whereby it is provided.
Yep.
Okay. That's where we
are. So anyway, so after what we just talked about, the argument from absurdity and the argument as to the effects, now we're at, now we come to the scriptures. What does it actually say in the scripture? Right, whereby it's proved that the seat of Antichrist is going to be in Jerusalem, not Rome. So the first is chapter 11 of the Apocalypse, where John says that Enoch and Elijah are going to fight with Antichrist in Jerusalem and must be killed there by the same Antichrist. Quote, and they will throw their bodies in the streets of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom, in Egypt, where even the Lord was crucified, unquote. So Arethus, another early father, says in this passage, their bodies he will cast out unburied into the streets of Jerusalem, for in it he will reign as king of the Jews. Likewise, all other interpreters show, and this can be rightly be said to be Jerusalem, and it cannot be denied. For what city is it in which this Lord was crucified but Jerusalem?
Right.
And so then this is why David Catreus, who would rather the city were Rome, passes over the words, where even their Lord was crucified, as if they did not pertain to the matter, or as though he had not read them. Nor is it opposed to what Jerome says when he tries to show that Jerusalem cannot be called Sodom, since everywhere in Scripture it is called the Holy City. For in that epistle he persuades Marcellus that, after leaving Rome behind, he should come into Palestine, and there he can heap up all those places in praise of Jerusalem, and in censure of Rome, and try to excuse Jerusalem in every manner. Nor does he do it in his own name, but in the name of Paul and Eustochius, to whom he thought forgiveness must be given if they were to explain something a little differently than the matter stood. That the earthly Jerusalem can be called Sodom on account of the lust and crimes of the Jews is also clear from Isaiah, who, when he prefaced a title of the first chapter, the vision of Isaiah, which he saw over Judah and Jerusalem, he next added, "Hear the word of the Lord, O princes of Sodom! Perceive with your ears the law of God, O my people Gomorrah!" Right, and so it's calling, you know, the Israel Sodom. It's not any kind of modern, you know, screed against the Jews. It's rather it's Old Testament. The Jews have failed God in the Old Testament, right, and persisted in their unbelief. So that you can apply Sodom and Gomorrah based on Isaiah to Jerusalem in the Apocalypse, and that's probably the very thing that John has in mind. So Anyway, it is not a valid, development continues, it's not a valid argument that Jerusalem is called holy, therefore it cannot be called Sodom. For just as in the same epistle, Jerome says that Rome is called Babylon by John, and the purple whore on account of the heathen emperors, and still, the same is holy on account of the Church of Christ, in the tombs of Peter and Paul. So also Jerusalem is the holy city, on account of the prophets and the apostles who preached there, on account of the cross of Christ and his tomb, and like things. Still, it is Sodom and Egypt on account of the crimes of infidelity of the Jews and their blindness, okay, which is perfectly evident from the Old Testament.
So he's saying that it's kind of like metaphorically Sodom and Egypt, right, not geographically Sodom and Egypt.
Just as we saw in Book 2 of the, or yeah, Book 2 of On the Roman Pontiff, where Bellarmine, you know, took it, was answering the Protestant Valenus about whether Peter really went to Rome or not. And then he says that, you know, Peter writes in his epistle, excuse me, we from Babylon greet you. And, you know, was Peter in actually the historic Babylon? Well, actually, it didn't exist at this time. It was a ghost town, because after, during the one of Alexander the Great's successor states, the Seleucids, who would go on to persecute the Maccabees, well, when they built a new capital, and the found, you know, Babylon had been so not taken care of for so long, and the area is really bad for, you know, it was built out of mud brick originally, and then covered over with stone and gold and other things, but and the foundations in that area of the world, you know, if you don't have something purely out of stone, and even if you do, the environment wreaks havoc on, you know, ancient structures. And so the real Babylon fell down, it fell apart sometime about 270 BC or so, if I'm not mistaken. And so there, in the new city was just north of it, Seleucia, and later it's called Ctesiphon. And then to the southwest along the Tigris, that's where Baghdad is. Right? And so there was no Babylon at the time that Peter wrote that epistle. And so he's using it metaphorically because Rome is called Babylon because it's like, you know, for the Jewish mind, what did Babylon represent? Kind of this big evil aggressor, you know, in the Old Testament. And so Rome is the new Babylon, and that's even before the time of Christ that is used in Jewish literature. So, you know, it makes, so whereas, and of course the Protestants everywhere say Rome's the whore of Babylon, right? Well, you know, the whole thing is, you know, the Babylon is becomes this metaphor for Rome. Right, but it doesn't say that's where Antichrist is going to reign. It says he's going to reign basically in Jerusalem, where the Lord was crucified. So then the second passage that Bellarmine takes up is Apocalypse 17, where John says there will be 10 kings who divide the Roman Empire, and from such rulers, Antichrist will come, having hatred for the purple whore, that is Rome, and are going to lay waste to her, even burn her with fire. How, therefore, will it be the seat of Antichrist if he's going to overturn it and burn it at the same time? So add, as we showed above, Antichrist will be Jewish and the Messiah of the Jews and a king. Therefore, without a doubt, he'll constitute his seat in Jerusalem, and he'll hasten to restore the Temple of Solomon. For the Jews dream of nothing other than Jerusalem and the Temple, nor do they seem ever to be going to receive anyone for a Messiah who would not sit in Jerusalem and restore the Temple in some way. Right? And so that's an interesting point there, too. Historically, after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, the Jews had actually received three different people as messiahs. The first one was Bar Kokhba, and that was in 140 AD. And, of course, heavily persecuted any Christians he found, had them martyred, and then started a war with the Romans, and, you know, pledged that he would rebuild Jerusalem when it was all done. Well, unfortunately, the Romans crushed him, and so although it took a little while, so then that's the end of him. And then you've got, you know, another, and then there's another guy in the Middle Ages that they received as a Messiah. And then the Turks said, well, it's not really a good idea. And, you know, kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And the guy converted to Islam, to the embarrassment and shame of all these guys that had just proclaimed it to be the Messiah, right? So, you know, typically, the, you know, but the thought of recovering Jerusalem is present in Jewish thought, not just in Zionism, but it goes back in Middle Ages, you know, medieval thought as well. And of course, today, there's a lot of the talk of rebuilding the temple. But you've got one problem, of course, that the Dome of the Rock is there. So that's not going to work, at least not in the present situation. So that's, but it's one of the things you see in the early church. When Julian the Apostate was the Roman Emperor, and he was trying to restore paganism, he took special care of the Jews and actually worked to rebuild the temple. And St. John Chrysostom relates that when they were trying to rebuild the temple, that fire actually came up and consumed men from the foundations. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly at the time, the project to rebuild the temple completely failed. So that was because the idea behind rebuilding the temple is, in a way, like undoing what Christ did. In many ways, the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, most Christians took as a judgment on the old on the Jews for not receiving their Messiah, right? So rebuilding the temple is like an undoing of that. And that's why it features in with Antichrist and why it's even foretold he's going to build the temple of Solomon. And so he cites various fathers, you know, on this subject. But that's basically the matter of it. You know, he's going to rebuild that temple. That's why it says to sit in the temple of God.
Right.
So then the third passage he brings up is St. Paul. So that he would, you know, because this whole question of he's going to sit in the temple of God, right? And so Bellarmine adds, although some fathers give different expositions of this, some also understand that the minds of the faithful through the temple of God, in which Antichrist is said to sit after he'll have seduced them, just as Anselm expresses. But some understand Antichrist himself by the means of temple, with the whole people, because Antichrist is going to want himself and his own to seem like a true spiritual temple of God, that is the true church, as Augustine explains. But there he deduces this exposition from the manner of speaking which Paul uses, because he did not say in Greek, entonio, which is in the temple, but eis tonio, into the temple. Right? So as if to say the Antichrist will sit within the temple of God, just as if he, with his own, were the temple of God. Right? And that's how Augustine gets that idea. So although the annotation of Augustine is not necessary, for even if in Latin it is not correct when it says it to sit within the temple, rather than in the temple, still in Greek, it is not said incorrectly, kathizumai eis ten ekklesian, or eis tonion, as it's commonly read. So that he's going to sit in the temple rather than in the church. Some understand the churches of Christians, which Antichrist will command to serve him, as Chrysostom interprets. Still, the exposition is the more common, probable, and literal of those who teach that for the temple of God is understood the temple of Solomon, in whichever renewed temple that Antichrist will sit in. Especially in the New Testament, the churches of Christians are never understood for the word temple of God. Rather, it is always understood as to refer to the temple in Jerusalem. Right? Because back in those days, the temple was still there in the New Testament. And then, you know, the couple of books written after, I think the only one written after is the Apocalypse. But when you say temple, that means Jerusalem, or Nion in Greek. And so you don't mean the houses of Christians, because even very early on, it's not until much later that they'll use the word temple really to describe churches, because a lot of churches met in houses, they met in secret, they met in hiding places. You didn't have like one specific building that was consecrated as a place of worship yet, or very rarely. You know, there'd be some places where you'd commonly meet, and people would bring relics of the martyrs to lay the place for saying Mass. But you wouldn't actually have a church until a little bit later.
So interesting. This is the Modern Wrong World Made Right. This is Calvin Was Wrong, Volume Number 2, Episode Number 10 here on the work of Antichrist by St. Robert Bellarmine. If you missed any of our previous 9 episodes, and then all the 28 episodes of the Volume 1 and Volume 2 series, you can get them online at VeritasRadioNetwork.com, VeritasRadioNetwork.com. Become a Founders Pass member today, which will gain you access to all of that brilliant work. All of it, all of it, all of it. And you can find it all there on the site. We will, Ryan, we'll pick up on this and finish up with Chapter 13 right after a brief timeout. I'd just like to call listeners' attentions to the bookstore at mikechurch.com/shop, where you can find Volume 1 and Volume 2 of this book, and you can also find Ryan's other works, including Antichrist, Volume 3, and you can find St. John Fisher, the biography of St. John Fisher, which was republished by Ryan Grant. That's all in my trade and post at mikechurch.com/shop, and also by shopping in Ryan's store at Mediatrix Press, MediatrixPress, Com. They're all available there as well. This will be a very brief break. We'll be right back. We'll finish up with chapter number 13 here, The Seat of Antichrist by St. Robert Bellarmine. And this is Calvin Was Wrong, Volume 2, Episode number 13, here on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. Radio the way it should be.